Good morning to everybody. Oh, I can take this thing off. You guys can't. Sorry, I had to say that. My wife sends her greetings. She is not here, but she is here. She's up the way a little way, hanging out with her cousin Pam. So she's really doing a lot better. The Lord has been good. Thanks for the prayers. She had that second MRI. And they've continued to say, oh, it looks like you're just fine. We just don't know why you're weird. So she's fine but weird, as you all knew that anyways. So she's really doing well. She does really good with short visits and, kind of one-on-one. She's done really well with that. And in fact, back in Yakima, since we have a little bit of a pad there to call home, we've had people over like once or twice a week, just some family or someone over, and so we're doing a lot of stuff over there, actually, in that sense of the word, maybe more than we should, but you got to live too, so we're enjoying that aspect of it a lot. But big groups kind of wipe her out, so that's why she decided she best probably between health and the big group she'll wait on until the next one before she sees you guys here in person. So sends her greetings though. That's message delivered there. All right, let's look at what we have for a message here. You guys know where that place is? Anybody? Come on, someone's done it. This is the Great Northwest in the wintertime. Anybody? Again? No, not quite. This is Franklin Falls. Franklin Falls, and it's right next to the freeway. In fact, if you change the angle, you can kind of see the freeway going up above, but it's about a mile something hike to get there. And when I was about little guy, 8, 9 years old, with my brother Matthew, maybe 10, maybe 11, right in there, and maybe they even tucked Jerry in the mix there, my grandpa was really excited. Grandpa Pacini, he's a big hiker. And he was really excited to show off Franklin Falls. So winter day, we drove on up there. You wanted to see the frozen falls. This was what was so cool. See all the ice hanging off the rocks and all that. It makes a spectacular picture. We got up there in the car, and my mom and my grandma and probably Gina, the ladies all stayed in the car drinking hot chocolate. And my grandpa and my dad made us march and march. And our toes got cold and frozen, and we were marching, and we were saying, are we there yet? And we kept going, and we kept going. Why are we going? What's there to see anyways? Who cares if there's water frozen? We see that any place. And we kept marching and marching, and when we finally got there, we just about sat down and cried, yes, you brought us out to see this? Who cares? Anyways, my grandpa and my dad had to take pictures of everything before we could return, and we were just, why are we here? We were saved by a snowmobile that day. Snowmobile, and guy and his wife on a snowmobile. It was kind of early days for snowmobiles. Like, they were kind of weird things. We heard this two-cycle engine makes it's a special screech in the woods, and it came screeching up, and these guys looked us over, and we were whining and complaining loud enough that they heard us. Well, we can give them a ride back to the car if you want. And we were like, yes, please. So again, I don't know if it was all three of us kids or just Matthew and I, but we got a ride back to the car, and we were saved from this. But I don't remember a thing about Wallace Falls. I had to look it up on the internet to find out what it looks like. And it's kind of, wow, that's kind of nice. I could appreciate that view, and maybe I should have back then, but quite honestly, cold toes, man. That's all I remember. Cold feet and hungry bellies, and they're having hot chocolate in the car. Why can't I be over there? Why did you drag me out here to do this? That's all I remember, and a lot of grumbling. So hungry bellies and sore feet seem to cloud our minds a lot of times when there could be something really special we're missing out on, but we're looking out for hungry bellies and sore feet a lot of times. Exodus chapter 17 is going to bring this up in a very particular way, I think. We're going to talk about a couple of fun things in this portion. Water from the rock is a neat topic, a neat thing to see. But before they get to the water from the rock, which is the title my Bible put to it, we're going to get an awful lot of grumbling. So let me read out what it says. Exodus 17, verse 1 to 3 says, "Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin," and that's not sinning, but sin, it's just the name, "according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?' But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?'" And the grumbling is well on its way here in this portion. Now, you've got maybe a little bit of review. First off, let me just say a typical way to interpret the children of Israel through the book of Exodus while they're in the desert is to really parallel that with our Christian life and say, look, God treats Israel this way. God saves Israel this way. God puts them through the waters of baptism, for example. And we have all these neat pictures of our Christian life paralleling. It's a picture. And that's certainly a valid interpretation. But again, it's a little bit pick and choose your interpretation. There's definitely heavy on interpretation, and it comes one shape or another. So, be that as it may, it's still valid, and we should pick out the lessons. We'll see a good verse that points us to the lessons of the Israelites in the desert is good lessons for us to remember, but it doesn't exactly specify which lessons. So, possibly we make too much of it sometimes, but still, there is a really interesting thing happening here just looking at Israel. See, Moses has the plan. Moses is the leader. Moses is God's man, and he's taking them somewhere quite special. A few years back, Moses was at this place or a very similar place, and he saw a burning bush. It was in the same wilderness. It was in the same vicinity. And God says, "Moses, I want you to go back to Egypt, get the people of Israel, pull them out. It's going to be a big project. And when you have done this, I want you to come back and worship me here." Same place. So Moses is completing the circle. Moses is approaching the destination. This is what God told him to do. He's following orders. He knows where he's going more or less in the sense that he's following orders. And maybe there was water last time he was here, but it's the desert. It changes. And 3 years later, and I don't know what happened. I thought there was water here, but, on we go. We'll still make it. So they're coming along. Moses is looking forward to something great. "I saw God here last time, and I want these people to see God. I want them to see what I saw. I saw a burning bush, and God spoke to me. And I don't know what we're going to see, but we're going to see God out here in this desert." So Moses is quite excited about this. But the people, They're talking about hungry bellies and sore feet. They're caught up in thirst. They're caught up in comfort issues, and they can't see past it. They're stuck on this. This is not going for them. So, a big popular protest develops. Talk about protests that we've been seeing in the country against leaders, but this is a protest against Moses, and there's a little something extra here. They're protesting against Moses, and the wording isn't just, we're upset at Moses. Oh, I could give you another slide here. Let's go for another slide. They're not just protesting against Moses and what he's doing. Moses is turning around and saying, you're protesting against God. But the protest isn't just, hey, we're upset at you, Moses. It's more, the wording is, we're going to sue you. We're going to strip you of authority. We're going to take away your right to be the leader. We're going to have a little revolution here and make up our own new constitution here. It's that kind of feel is in the crowd. They're going to redefine the situation and get rid of Moses. And Moses is possibly going to be stoned, as we'll see. That's his wording later on. So It's a popular protest, but Moses turns it around and tells the people, you're complaining against me, but you're testing God. And he turns this on a spiritual thing and says, you know, I'm not the one who decided to be the leader here. I protested. I was saying I don't want to be the leader. And yet, now you're, you know, it's a really awkward position. He didn't want to be here anyways. Yeah. On we go. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 15. And thankfully, I think we have it there. Can you read that? Oh, look at that. This is so handy. Hebrews 12, 15 and 16 has this to say, see to it that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many are defiled, that there be no immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. Interesting to bring up Esau here, but that was definitely a comfort issue over the spiritual, and he missed out. So what Hebrews is saying, be careful that you don't miss out on God's big plan, on God's desire to do the greatest thing in your life because of some little comfort, trivial issue, and you pass on it. A sad reality here. So the application here is missing opportunities of faith because of a selfish attitude, because our eyes are only seeing the physical, because our eyes are only seeing the practical things, the things that we are comfortable with. There is a possibility. This definitely can happen. It's happening here with these grumbling people. And God's going to overwork it and overpower it. And he does that in our life by grace and mercy. He kind of pushes us through situations sometimes and says, yeah, you really need this anyways. So I'm going to overrule that. And he pushes us into certain things. Verses 4 to verse 8, verse 7. Exodus 17 again, verse 4. And it says, so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do to this people? A little more and they'll stone me. Then the Lord said to Moses, pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and it turned to blood, if you recall. And go, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarrel with the sons of Israel and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? And that's what those two words mean. Quarrel and testing. That's what he named the place. God does provide water from the rock. This is a neat expression of God's mercy, I think, in spite of attitude issues, in spite of lack of faith. God pushes through and says, yeah, I'm gonna save you. Grumbling isn't the way to get on God's good side. And if you look at what has started here as the grumbling and the protesting, it's hard to be a leader in this situation. It's hard to want to be a leader. Moses' case is particular. He clearly did not want to be the leader, and yet God says, yeah, you're the man. Yeah, you're the man. Get up there. I want you to do this. And after he took that position, when things went bad, Moses was quick to say, but God, why did you put me in this place? I told you I didn't want to be here. I told you I didn't want to do this. So it's hard to be a leader. It's hard to ever to stay popular. You know the old saying, right? You can always please some people, but you can never please everyone, right? Something like that. How does that saying go? You've heard it? It's true. And being a leader and trying to be popular, trying to be a pleaser of everybody, isn't going to happen. You'll never please everybody. You can often please some people. You can often not please anybody. But it still might be the right thing to do. So being a leader is a hard place to be. And Moses is complaining about that right now. I don't know if you've ever had this happen to you, but honestly, every one of us is a leader. You're a leader to your children. And sometimes that's not a popular, that's not a popularity. If it was a popularity contest, you've ever read your Calvin and Hobbes. If you're all up to date on that, you know. Calvin is always reading out the polls to his dad and saying, Dad, you're not doing so well in the polls. And you know what? Dad says, I don't care. It's tough. It's tough to be a dad, a mom, and you're not doing so well on the polls. That's just the way it is. But we will sometime be a leader to children, to a classroom, to a work detail. Sometimes we have to play that role of a leader, and popularity is hard to come by. And if you really look for popularity over leadership, actually making the hard decisions that are good for the job, for the situation, you'll fail in the end. It all comes back and bites you. So Moses is finding this a difficult thing. But God fixes two problems. He says, well, I'm going to fix both problems. I'm going to fix the grumbling problem, the water problem, and I'm going to fix the leadership problem, Moses. So he says, Moses, and he gives him kind of a recipe. He says, go to all the people, and from all the people, pick out the leaders, the elders. And you take those elders, and you then take Moses and and you take your staff, and you kind of lead the procession out, and you make it visibly clear that God is in charge. And then it's the staff of God, Moses, the elders, and the people. So there's a clear hierarchy of command laid out in the way God words his instructions to Moses. So Moses goes through this little procession and marches his way out, maybe a mile, maybe two, over to the rock of Horeb, some rock that God has chosen. It's mentioned before, which makes me think, wow. Exodus 3:1 mentions this rock before. Is it the rock that he mentions? Let me just look that one up. So they're going to go to this rock, and God is going to produce water from the rock with striking it. So it's a miracle. They're going to see God in action. They're going to see God provide for them. Let me just see that. Exodus 3:1 says, now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. It doesn't say the rock of Horeb, but it's the Horeb region. I think it's a range of mountains. So it's indistinct. It's not precisely one rock, but this is a distinct one rock. And then you have another rock show up, and we'll read that funny verse in Corinthians where the rock follows them. That's a weird one. Moses takes his problems to God. God fixes the problem. Strike the rock, and we're going to have a solution. As soon as Moses strikes this rock, he's going to have peace. That's a blessing. All right, protest is over. Grumbling's over. We have peace. We have life. We've solved the thirst problem. We've solved the comfort issue. And we have a guaranteed way to say, we can stay here. We can camp as long as we need to. As long as there's water, we can camp here. We've solved a critical issue. We have water. We have life, and water and life go together. Jesus makes that point later on when he speaks of being the life, or I'm sorry, being the water of life, he says to the Samaritan woman. And he brings that up one way and another. Basically, salvation. Striking the rock is a picture of salvation. And this is where a lot of I think, healthy, good interpretation makes this a picture of Christ. When they struck the rock, we're looking at a picture of Jesus Christ being struck with grumbling, with complaining, with attitude. But as he was struck, he produced life for us. So it becomes a neat, really neat picture of Jesus Christ on our behalf. Okay? I don't know. There's a lot of people tie this rock with the next time the rock shows up, and you're not supposed to strike it. You're supposed to speak to it. More a picture of confession of sin. And life comes forth again without having to strike the rock as Jesus was struck for our sins. So make of that what you may. Study that out some more. This is a good thing. 1 Corinthians 10:4, we have it here written out, says, and all drink, and we're talking about these people, these Israelites, all drink the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them through the desert, see? And the rock was Christ. So this is a point that Paul's making. Paul's bringing this out to us as Christians, saying, this is our rock. And when we look at Christ, we have a rock who produces salvation, produces life-giving water. And he was struck for us, but we can speak to him, and he will produce life for us. And he follows us. So some neat thoughts to be pulled up from this Corinthians passage, something to look up and meditate on, I think. Jesus is our rock of life and salvation. And you know what? This is the point that we were making earlier. It's worth walking through a desert. It's worth getting sore feet. It's worth feeling the thirst to be able to see Jesus Christ and to be able to meet him and to see the salvation that he brings to us. A lot of us may not feel that it's worth it at some place, and that's a decision of faith that you make one way or you make the other. But it is worth it, because when we've met Christ and when we have the rock of salvation and when we have that relationship established, then we have life for the duration. Otherwise, we might make all the good decisions, but it's always maybe this is a good decision, maybe it's not. And you're on your own through the desert. You're still going to go through the desert, but are you going to go find Christ? Or are you going to go out and find your own comfort? So walking with Christ, and it is a walk. There's more to be said on this in various ways. Romans 13:1 has these reminders for us, and this is in regards to authority. This is in regards to don't challenge authority so nilly-willy and freely. There is something to be said for God stands behind the authorities that he puts in place. This is hard for us, and our society is proving that to us on a daily basis in the news and other places. It's hard to accept the authorities that are in place, and thankfully we have elections so we can choose our authorities. And a lot of people have found solace in this, but ultimately, when it's all said and done, God has permitted, allowed, even established the authorities of all sorts, not just at a national level, but at a home level, at work level, at school. In so many different places, we have authorities. And we need to work within. This is what God favors. He favors authority. Romans 13:1 says, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. And that's pretty general. For there is no authority, and that's very general, except from God. And those which exist are established by God. So any authority that's out there that has authority legitimately is to be listened to in order to honor God. And that's taking some interpretation right now for a lot of people, because we have challenging authorities. We have national authority, state authorities at odds with each other. And boy, it takes a little bit of wisdom. It takes some understanding to know how do we walk these lines when we're living in a society that doesn't really accept authority, and we as children of God have to decide to accept authority anyways. How do we do that? Titus 3:1, second reminder, says, remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed. And I like the way that verse ends, because sometimes we look at authorities and all we see is the mess. All we see is the problem. But be ready for every good deed. How do we find the good at the end of this? How do we seek to do the good that maybe the authorities aren't seeing? Maybe they're not getting it. But we want to see through and seek the good as far as our arm can reach, as far as we can reach out to others. Pleasing others. So this is our first picture of grumbling in the desert. They walk out in the desert. They just about missed God for all their grumbling. They just about lynch Moses, and God solves the problem. They do see God, but they may not have appreciated him the way they should have. They may not have understood just how great a picture they have in front of them. And God is actually going to repeat this picture for them later on. I believe that, comes up later on in the discussion. So the next thing that happens at the camp, they've set up camp, they're next to the waters, they've settled in, the grumbling has stopped, it may have taken a few days, and now that they've set up camp, and that was a good description of how they set up camp around the tabernacle. They didn't have the tabernacle yet, though, but they've camped, they've stationed themselves, and all of a sudden they have a war threat develop against them. They have the Amalekites come out and attack. And there's two readings of this. One is in Deuteronomy 25, 17 and 19. And you get another reading of how the Amalekites attack. And it's a sneak attack. They're coming in from the back. They're attacking from the rear. They're picking off the stragglers. They're picking off the ones that are going out for, you know, some kind of outlying duties. They have these raiding parties. And Moses says, we got to deal with this head on. We can't let them pick off the stragglers. This is not good. We've got to secure the camp. So Moses is going to send out, let me see, let's read it. Here we go, verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Ur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hands down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him. So he sat on it. And Aaron and Ur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. This is it's a battle. It's the first battle they're going to fight. They haven't fought any battles before. They haven't pulled out their swords yet. They've never done this before. This is new. First time they have to fight. They thought they'd have to fight at the edge of the Red Sea, but God opened a way of escape. But now it's time to fight. It's time to defend the camp. And as they're doing this, Moses gives the task to Joshua. The commissions him as a military leader at this time. So look at this. The first thing I want to note before we get into that is Amalek is a cousin. It's a relative of Israel. See, Amalek was a grandson of Esau, the brother of Jacob, who is called Israel. So kind of a cousin family tribe. It's probably not Amalek out there. It's probably descendants of Amalek. But they're a cousin tribe. You would kind of want to trust them. You would kind of think there's some safety in being near these guys. You know, their war will be our war. We're kind of family. They might have thought it's okay to camp out this side of the woods. We've got Amalek over there. We can kind of lean on them. They're family. They'll respect this. But Amalek starts putting on these raiding parties and starts picking off the stragglers. Deuteronomy 25, and I will read this now if I can find it quickly. Deuteronomy 25, 17 is a reminder of this time. Remember what Amalek did to you along the way when you came out from Egypt. How he met you along the way and attacked among you all the stragglers at your rear when you were faint and weary out of water, see? And he did not fear God. Therefore it shall come about when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your surrounding enemies in the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You must not forget. So this was a sneak attack. This was tough on them. The battle comes up on two fronts. And Joshua's going to take the military front. But notice there's another front of this battle. There's a spiritual front to this battle. And Moses says, I'm going to take the spiritual front. I'm going to take the staff of God, which has just been used to strike the rock, the staff of God with which they struck the Nile, with which they raised over the Red Sea. This is the picture of God is somehow in the staff of God. And I'm going to go and I'm going to do the spiritual intercession or lift up. I'm not sure that we always think this is prayer, whether it was prayer or not, but it's the staff of God. And it's the spiritual side of things. And Joshua, though, you can't just say, oh, we'll just pray and God will just take care of our enemies. No, Joshua, you're going to have to actually sharpen them swords, polish them back up, get whatever other tools you got going, and put together a military force. This is going to take some organizing, planning, real blood and sweat, and you're going to have to get out there and do this as well. So it's a two-front attack. One is very much physical, and the other is very much spiritual. And as Joshua is commissioned the first time as a military leader, later on he's known as the servant of Moses and comes up in the ranks and is again the overall leader when they're entering in the promised land 40 years later after this event, more or less. Now, Ur is an interesting guy. He shows up here. He shows up one more time. He gets a spiritual commission in the future alongside of Aaron. And they're supposed to look after the people while Moses goes up to the mount. Well, he doesn't do a terribly good job on that, but he is another spiritual figure within Israel. I don't know if anyone's sure who Ur was, but some tradition points to him as the husband of Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron. So possibly he's a relative by marriage and a well-respected man in Israel. So at this time, we don't have the tribe of Judah selected out. We don't have the Levites. We don't have any of this is organized. That's still coming. But for now, we have leadership in these three men, Moses, Aaron, and Ur. And Moses, of course, is speaking on behalf of the Lord. So he's the lead guy here. When they go up on the hill, this battle goes back and forth, and there's some kind of spiritual war, and it tells us the relationship. When the spiritual war is going on, when that staff is raised over the camp up on the rock on the mountain, looking down on the battle, when the staff is up, Israel wins. But when the arm gets tired, the guys are still going at it, but they're not winning anymore. They're losing. So when the spiritual side goes back up, and they kind of started watching and saying, hey, look, we win, we lose. We win, we lose. This is interesting. We figured out the relationship here. They figured that out pretty quick. They were very observant. And this is, we got to win. And Moses says, yeah, my arm's getting tired. And Aaron says, well, will it work if I lift it up? He says, nope. It's got to be Moses. Oh, man, my arm's still tired. Use the other arm. Okay. Now both arms are tired. What are we going to do? So they come to a solution and say, well, we'll sit you down and we'll hold your arms up. We're going to go all day here and we're going to get through this. This is going to be a marathon, a spiritual marathon, all day to sundown. And they won. But it's a great picture of how to win certain wars, certain battles. And again, that the parallel with our Christian life. Not everything is on the physical side. And this brings me to a lot of psychology. I appreciate a good amount of psychology, and I understand that not all of it is Christian. I understand there's a lot of worldly influences in psychology. So I have my antennas up pretty carefully when you bring up psychology my direction, but I appreciate it a lot because, hey, we act that way. A lot of the time it's true. It's worth paying attention to. But if you just want to fight the war from a natural, physical, this is the way mankind works, so if you have this addiction, let's just substitute with this, and let's do that and the other. Let's do a few tricks, and it'll... Yeah, well, you try that out, but you're going to find out you need the spiritual side along. And the spiritual side is a lot harder to measure than the psychological side. So we need to fight it both ways. And some people get all spiritual and say, well, just pray about it, brother. Don't bother taking the antidepressant pills. Okay, just pray about it, right? Yeah, well, sometimes you need to fight the battle on both fronts. So there's a good place, and in a lot of things in our life, there's a good place to mix and match. You don't want to be dependent on the physical. The physical won't win. You want to be dependent on the spiritual. But you need to bring in both sides and work together. A lot of times in our own personal life, one of our closest, nearest, and dearest enemies is our flesh. And Amalek brings up a picture of our flesh. Right alongside of our flesh is our addictions, our bad habits, our, you know, sin nature is so insidious. We get into that little bad habit of, you know, I just like watching movies, you know, and I just get bored if I'm not watching something. And, you know, the movies aren't that great anymore, but, you know, I just kind of feel like I need to relax, you know. And the comfort zone starts creeping in. And it's like, wait, sometimes what we're watching gets downright bad. And do we have our antennas up? Are we seeing that? Or are we ignoring that and letting it slide in and creep into our lives? So it needs to be, if you ever try to fight it, you'll know. If you ever say, okay, hey, I've made a decision. I'm going to stop this particular sin in my life. Well, you just try that. See how that goes for you. You know, those who have had serious, all sorts of sins are addictive. But if you've had something like smoking or drinking problems in your life, if you've ever had to stop them, the battle starts the day you say, I'm going to really stop this. That's not the day you stop. That's the day you start fighting it. And man, get all the help you can get. Certainly the spiritual help. Certainly the prayer help. Get other people to pray for you. But you're going to need to reinforce that decision with a lot of other things too. It's not going to be a walk in the park. And all people, you know, they break. I stopped smoking. Yes. Oh yeah, right. Not so easy. A lot harder to do than you think. And our society is full of so many different kinds of addictions nowadays. But are we equipped to fight them? And as a church, as believers, are we equipped to guide somebody through this? Or are we like, oh, well, we don't do that kind of stuff here, so maybe you shouldn't come. That's nice, isn't it? We only want good people in our church. Well, what about messed up people? How do we help them solve this? That's a challenge. And that should be a concern to us as a church, to say, how do we solve people's problems? How do we help them overcome situations, you know? Debt can be an issue. How do we help people overcome that? Anyways, don't want to go off too far, but there's a lot of soapboxes that come to mind here. There is spiritual warfare out there, and it should match the sin that surrounds us. We need to fight it both spiritually and practically so many times. Ephesians 6:17 takes us to the spiritual side. It says, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints. So prayer is a neat tool to use. You can pray for yourself. You need to. But you can pray for others. It works as well. God listens to prayer on behalf of others. It works as intercession, and it works as a plea for our own needs immediately. So the Lord is on our side. There are enemies that never leave us, addictions, temptations of the flesh. Sometimes it's our past guilt, something we did that we just can't seem to forgive ourselves for. We got to fight against them again and again and again. And we fight these things with the word, with the sword, with truth, with practical things, and we have the help of the Spirit coming alongside of us and giving us that supernatural help that's beyond our own abilities. And we can turn to the Spirit of God to help us. And that's a great encouragement. Last part, and this will be quick. I think I've enjoyed my time a little too much. Let's move it along here. Verse 14 says, Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that it will utter that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. And fun to see what has happened now. We read what Moses ended up writing in the book of Numbers, I believe. I think it was. Was that Numbers, Deuteronomy? Yeah, whatever. He wrote it down. He told them. He reminded them a few times. Don't mess with Amalek. We're destroying that. What we have here is Moses taking it in hand as well and building an altar right there on site, right there in the same place. It says, this is the altar. We're going to remember a couple of things here. We're going to remember our victory. We fought Amalek. We need to remember that. We need to remember this victory because, for one, it wasn't just the first fight that they had. This is the first battle that they had as a nation. And they won. That's a good deal. Not only is that important, but it's living proof that God fought alongside us. We fought, we went down to the battlefield, but God was fighting alongside of us. And we could see it. When the staff was up, we were winning. When the staff came down, we were losing. We know that. So God fought alongside us. That's why we won. This is an important memorial for Israel at this time. But it's also a memory of, altars can be a memory of defeat as well. You know, when Moses named this wonderful stream of water that come out of the rock, instead of naming it salvation, he names it grumbling and bitterness and complainers, whiners. That's what he names this stream bed. He's reminding them of their attitude. It's not just all hunky-dory now. We've got to remember our defeats as well as our victories. It's important to remember both. Let's not be just lopsided and look for one side only. But remembering both victory and defeat helps us in the process. So God gives them also here a curse to remember. He says, I want you to remember Amalek, but I want you to remember him to get rid of him. 1 Samuel 15 is a time in Israel when they had their first king on the stage, Saul, and Samuel says, God has a word for you. Get rid of Amalek. Go back to that war. Review this. Now's the time to go back and execute. And again, it has happened. That wasn't the end of Amalek, even though it was a good riddance for a while. Amalek seems to have come back a few descendants in the book of Esther with Haman was the Agagite, and his name shows up in the records of the Amalekites. So it's possibly a descendant of the Amalekites that was after Israel again. So there's some, it's a little more obscure in that one. But you get to deal with Amalek once and twice, and you think you dealt with it, you'll get to deal with it again. So remember the curse. Remember what is bad, and every time you meet it, it's still bad. For us, when we fight sin, when we have victory over sin, great, praise the Lord, let's worship, let's remember this, though, and when it comes up again, let's be ready for it. Fight that battle again. Some battles we have to fight over and over. There's a long process involved. Moses names this place, God is my banner. And that is a. I think it's probably more poetic than we get. I mean, to us, a banner is just a flag waving. Great, cool, there's a flag waving. But I think what Moses means is the emphasis is on God is my flag. God is on my side. It's not just that I'm on God's side when I do it right, but God is actually on my side. And he's fighting for me, and he's on my team. So this becomes a little more significant maybe than the wording easily reads. It's the promise that you can always call on God when you're fighting an enemy. It's a promise, a reminder to the people, remember that God is still and always will be on our side. That's the promise. So this name is a promise. And just for us to think, we're always going to have battles. They're going to keep coming our way, these battles. They're not going to be going away. They might come from behind. They might come from close by. It might be friends. It might be relatives. They might be sneak attacks. You know, the sneakiest attack of all is our pride when we do it all good. And we're patting ourselves on the back for what a good Christian we are. That's a sneak attack, guys. And we've got to learn to recognize those. As soon as we think we did it good, boy, we got to check ourselves, right? Peter says that. Says he who thinks he's got it all put together. Be careful, you're about to trip and fall on your face. Paraphrase version of what Peter said. But that's how it is. It's our pride is a big sneak attack. Psalm 46:1 says, God is our refuge and strength, very present help in trouble. And that's the picture of God is my banner, my standard. Just like Moses had the staff in his hand and he could raise it up and see God's hand go into town against the enemies, so can we. we have access to the same staff. We have access to call on God and ask Him to be part of our battle. Join in our fight. And He's there. And He'll join us. We have to ask. The other verse here is 2 Corinthians 1:4 says, this is an introduction, but he's talking about God. God who comforts us in all our afflictions so that we will be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. And we've got battles, we've got struggles, we've got things to go through, and when we go through them, boy, we cry out to God. But when we're done, don't erase the file. Don't forget about the trouble. Don't misuse the lessons you've learned. God says now you have something that you can use when you see others. When you see others going through difficult troubles, you are now a legitimate, bona fide comforter. As you have been comforted, go encourage them. Go comfort them. And that's what our battles are for. This is another good reason to remember our victories as well as our failures and say, I've got a story of what God did in my life. And I need to share that with you. I think this would be appropriate as I've heard your story and I've heard your trouble. So this is a really great application verse. It's almost directly there. God is also our banner in time of trouble. And when we need to draw near to Him for victory, but we could also point others, other believers, other brothers and sisters who are in trouble, hey, you should pray about this. God can be your banner too. God can comfort and be a part of your victory as well. So beating God in the wilderness, going back to that first thought, and life is kind of an uncharted desert sometimes. We really don't know what we're going to get into. We don't know if where we're going next has water or if it's just a dry desert. We keep making the best decisions we can, and sometimes we're overcautious maybe. But as we go into this uncharted life that is ahead of us, as Christians, we do know who's going with us. We do know what the destination is at the end. So, you know, even though we don't know what's next, we kind of know the end. We kind of know the purpose of the whole thing. We're going to go meet God. And we can actually meet God in the desert through the trials. And we can see some pretty awesome things. There's some pretty spectacular things that God wants to show us along the way. So let's be on the lookout for God as we walk the wilderness ahead of us, as we walk the uncharted path ahead of us. Let's be on the lookout for God and not just think about sore feet and hungry bellies. Not just think about comforts that are near and dear at this moment. That's it for this morning, and I think I will close in prayer. Let's pray. Thank you, Father, for the study in your word, for the look at Israel, for their struggles, for their victories, and for their failures and grumblings, and we see ourselves in so many of the situations we've encountered. We thank you that you are our banner, that you are there for our next struggle, for the next fight we have, that you're right there for us and that we can call on you. And we thank you for what we've learned along the way. Pray that you would encourage us and help us to be that blessing to others as others struggle alongside of us. Thank you for this time together. Thank you for your blessing and provision in a time of difficulty in this nation with this COVID pandemic, that we can have the refreshment of coming to you and meeting with saints each week. In Jesus' name, amen.